Here's something you might not know about wireless. Sometimes what you see isn't what you get. But with Visible, what you see is what you get. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 per month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with a king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to season 235, episode 2 of Der Daily Zeitgeist! Ah! It's a production of iHeartRadio, and this is a podcast where we take a deep dive into America's shared consciousness. It is Tuesday, May 3rd, 2022, which of course means it's National Teacher Appreciation Day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, do you have a teacher that you want to shout out?
I feel like we've talked about this a lot, but I always say my history teacher, Mr. Woolery, because he gave me the appreciation for history, and I ended up studying that in college. Mm. But also, I got to shout out one of my first music teachers, Judy Clausen, who was like really made me like feel good about being good at an instrument, like was made it like a connected the pathways in my brain to be like, oh, like it was very encouraging. And you know, I would say that I'm not into music as much as I would be today without her encouragement. Mm. Shout out Miss Kloss.
There you go. I think I shouted out Miss McDonald last time, mm-hmm. my seventh grade writing teacher. I'll go with Professor Wexel, my first philosophy professor, who was really into Star Trek and got me into
and made
philosophy.
You insufferable that
and
first
made
Christmas
me the
breakback.
Worst.
Guys, I'm just, you know, I can believe what I heard in my philosophy class.
Well, my name is Jack O'Brien, a.k.a. Potatoes O'Brien, and I'm thrilled to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Miles Gray!
Out the window! I'ma crawl! Even though it's way too small! Out this bus I fall!
Okay, shout out to Fighter of the Nightman on Discord, because yes, last time we were racking our brains over who closes the school bus door. You know, when the driver's done.
Yeah.
Are we crawling out the window? Are we just reaching our arm in? Are we releasing the hydraulics? It was a much simpler answer, but again, it inspired a great Yin Yang Twins.
One of the best. And the answer was just like that you can just open and close those doors.
Yeah.
Just turn on when the hydraulics are turned off.
You can release the hydraulic pressure in the door and then just close it manually when you get out. So it wasn't some, you know, magic trick or newfangled instrument that they used.
Yeah. My theory that all bus drivers are shapeshifters mm-hmm. turned out not to be true. I think we edited it out of the episode, but it went on for like 25 minutes.
Yeah. When you were like, how did they get that thin? Like paper to get through the little schism in between.
Well, Miles, we are thrilled to be joined in our third and fourth seat by the hosts of the podcast What Could Go Right from the Progress Network. It's Zachary Carabell and Emma Varbaluca.
Zachary and Emma!
What's up, guys?
Welcome.
Hey.
Wow. I think we're going to have to learn, Emma, to amp up the energy level on our usually sedate and measured set of interviews. Clearly, we've lost some decibel level that we need to incorporate. So if else, we've learned that from the conversation so far.
I was different thinking strokes. My last name was made for that. Like, that was perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My last Luca! Name is never positive.
Yeah. It's got like good syllables. It's musical because you got four syllables in there. Yeah.
Gives you some time to like get revved up a little bit. The Varba gets you ready for the Lucas.
Oh, thanks, guys. This is a change from middle school. I'm into it.
I know, great. Right?
Yeah. Well, You're getting teased?
Varba Mucus. That was the one.
That kind of sucks.
Do you ever wish you could go back and, like, as an adult and be like, guys, these are the worst insults I've ever heard. Like, honestly. Like, and I know they're cutting at this age, but y'all, like, really, this is not a great showing.
You could do better.
Yeah. Well, going through the 80s and early 90s with the name Jack was, and like not a lot of Jacks out there. So there was a lot of fun stuff going on. So I feel your pain.
We all have our crosses to bear.
Yeah. Right. Also not the highest quality material, believe it or not. But how are you guys doing? Where are you coming to us from?
I'm in New York City.
I've heard of it.
I'm in Athens, Greece.
But okay. No, I have not heard of that. No. How are things in Athens, Greece? What time is it there?
It's almost 10 o'clock at night.
All right.
Yeah.
So you're just starting to think about dinner. And
that is the Greek schedule. I ate at like 9. You're not wrong.
Yeah. Nice. All right. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. We are going to get to know you a little bit better in a moment. First, we're going to tell our listeners a couple of the things we're talking about today. We're going to talk about this New York Times article that's basically like the Democrats have found themselves with a conundrum for the midterms and 2024, which is that the vibes are all fucked up. Seems to be. I mean, we've like run into this before in the history of the Democratic Party, where that seemed to be the like what people diagnosed the late 70s with was like, America's just like sad. And I think it was malaise. General malaise was one of the descriptors. But that seems to be kind of what Democrats are asking themselves heading into this midterm election. So we want to dig into that. We want to look at the Great Resignation as its demographics are shifting. We are going to talk vampire culture, all of that, plenty more. But first, we like to ask our guests, what is something from your search histories?
So one thing from my search history recently was, are there any female Greek rappers?
Okay.
The answer was, there's exactly one.
Okay.
I couldn't find any of her music, just her name, because I really like Greek rap, but it's like heavy misogynistic. And I was like, come on, there's got to be like a badass Greek lady out there that raps. Just one. Right. Can't find her music. So that's where we're at.
What's her MC name?
I think it's Sandazania or something like that.
Okay.
I didn't even get her name down correctly. That's how disappointing.
MC Varba Lucas.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Coming through.
In another lifetime.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Did you listen to a lot of hip hop in general? And like when you're like living in Greece, you're like, let me check on Greek hip hop. Or did you suddenly be like, I'm suddenly into Greek hip hop. And now you're looking for the female MCs. What's your relationship to the genre?
You know what? If my friends could hear that question, they would laugh really, really hard. I have a lot of friends who are into hip hop and rap in New York. And you know, I was living in New York for 10 years. And I was always the one that's like not up on the culture, like at all. But for some reason, when I moved here, when you go to the clubs or bars here, they just play Greek music. Like, they don't play American music at all. So I had to get into the Greek thing, and I was learning Greek, and I don't know, I just started to vibe with Greek rap for some odd reason. Maybe partly because they tend to be from the United States. They tend to be Greek Americans who rap here.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. Which really answers a lot of unasked questions. How rap came to Greece in the first place.
Right.
Yeah. What about you, Zachary? What's something from your search history?
Well, I did a piece last week for Time on billionaires owning media properties for the past 100 years in light of everybody's favorite billionaire maybe buying Twitter. I'm not going to mention the name just because I feel like, you know, if you don't know it, then... So there's a lot in my search history about billionaires and media ownership for the past 120 years of American media.
Mm-hmm. And what are your feelings about that trend and the continuance?
You know, I knew that lots of billionaires have bought contemporary media properties like Mark Benioff and Time, like Jeff Bezos in the Washington Post, like Lorraine Powell Jobs in the Atlantic. I wasn't as acutely aware of just how completely all media for most of American history, well, most of American history from the late 19th century through the present, has been owned by wealthy individuals and usually wealthy men.
Right.
It's pretty hard to find any media, newspaper, TV station, magazine that has not been owned by wealthy private individuals, which makes Musk's bid for Twitter seem much less of a new thing, even if it's a big deal.
It's like our media has been under billionaire control for quite some time, and we're at where we're at now.
Who'd have thought? Including iHeart. Just saying.
Yeah. No, 100%. I mean,
no. iHeart is the people. iHeart is owned by the people. We're like the Green Bay Packers of media outlets. No, it's definitely true. I mean, everything is.
Yeah, I mean, it was Clear Channel before, and they're like, rebrand.
That's true of like everything, like the everything in American culture. Maybe with the exception of the Green Bay Packers, right? Like, there's not much that is not owned by extremely wealthy people.
There is independent media, but not to the levels of what we're talking about, I guess, you know, in terms of pervasiveness, right? Like,
even what people like to think of as the countercultural or alt media, like The Nation and Harper's, you know, also owned by very wealthy individuals whose politics simply skew left.
Yeah, right. I don't know if I would lump them in there, but more like at the extremely local end, like where we had like weeklies and things that were at some point felt like they embodied something of like, oh no, this is ran by like human beings that you can identify, rather than where's the C-suite that makes all the decisions for this entity kind of thing.
What's something you guys think is overrated?
Ooh, other than the Green Bay Packers. Well, I mean, on that light, I'm sort of repeating myself. I think the concern that wealthy individuals owning media platforms is a threat to free speech. It's either we've never had it or we've always had it, and it has been neither here nor there to the ownership structure of these organizations.
Mm. So are you less concerned about Elon Musk doing it because... I'm assuming like part of the concern that a lot of people, including myself, are feeling is like how brazen and also like popular he seems to be. Like, it's the first time I could see like a billionaire coming through and being like, no, you can't write that about me. And like a bunch of people being like, yeah, you can't write that about Elon Musk. Whereas if Bezos like tried to kill a story about Amazon publicly in the Washington Post, that would probably be very unpopular. That said, I just feel like those stories never get to the front page of the Washington Post, right?
And you'd certainly have to wonder if there were multiple ongoing instances of criticism, like, you know, of Musk himself or anything that Tesla did or anything that Twitter did being routinely shut down, and then that having other reverberations. You know, one can set up a new social media platform of information, that doesn't have the network effect, but Trump was able to set up Truth Social. Now, the fact that he's running it really badly is neither here nor there in terms of the ease of actually creating one. So even there, it's not as if Twitter is like the sole and only public sphere of very sharp and often pungent commentary.
Yeah. I mean, you guys' general thesis on the podcast and on, like, it seems to be that, like, not enough And I agree with this in a lot of ways, that like a lot of the good news doesn't get reported. And so it like kind of goes into this, like we just hear the problems in the media. But then like this feels like one of the problems overall, like overarching, that like we don't hear about, which is that things are generally being vetted by a billionaire class that like owns all these things that are supposed to be talking to us. Like, would you agree with that? Or you think that like this is just a kind of a misreading of the current?
I think and Emma has a kind of aversion to the idea of good news as opposed to news that sort of points right. in a more constructive direction.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But for-profit news demands attention that can be measured in real time compared to other people getting the same eyeballs. And that's the same incentives for Netflix as it is for a newspaper. So the issue, I think, is less who owns than the structure of these things have to generate a profit. And what generates a profit is what is most immediately emotional and intense and outrageous and fearful and hot emotions rather than cool emotions. And that is as much the issue, irrespective of the ownership structure.
Yeah. Do you feel like something's changed with social media and like as compared to, you know, some of these legacy medias that like the New York Times was not running the sorts of headlines that now make a tweet go viral, right? Like there was some sort of difference or diminished heat like for through the editorial process, right?
I mean, Emma does a lot more of our, you know, a lot of the progress social media she kind of manages. And so the flip side of that is it's also been an amazing tool to have people find information and perspectives, right, Emma, that are that they have a hard time finding otherwise. You know, the connective tissue that these platforms still provide.
Mm-hmm. I think that the difference between social media and legacy media is just that the rules haven't been figured out yet. Like the rules of journalism have been around with legacy media for a really long time. So what's considered, you know, good editorial practice and bad editorial practice, what the rules are in relationship to ownership, for instance, those are pretty set. And if, you know, the American public doesn't know what they are, they should know what they are. Social media is still quite new. We're still figuring out the rules. We're trying to figure out, like, what does the space look like where it's kind of a public square, so issues of free speech are there, but it is also a privately owned company. So what does that mean? Who's responsible legally for the stuff that's published on the platform? It's just, I think we're going to work ourselves into a better place with that. It's just that we're in the messy middle at the moment.
Mm, yeah. What is something you think is overrated, Emma?
I was going to say the 5-day work week. Overrated. Overrated in the sense that we're all doing it.
Right.
What's ideal, you think? What's the balance here?
I would love to see us move towards 4. I think that would be better.
I mean, there are a few countries that are piloting that, right? And it seems like it's that so far it doesn't seem to be throwing economies into like a downward spiral.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that the only thing I would say to that is like it's a really small amount. It's like,
of course, right?
I can't remember which countries now exactly, but it's like the government of Iceland, I don't know, or like this one company here or there. But that's not to damper the enthusiasm about the pilot projects. Super into it. I hope it goes well. I hope there's absolutely no economic downturn and that productivity stays high so that it'll just the 4-day work week creep will continue to creep.
Mm-hmm. I thought the rub on Mediterranean countries was that they had essentially been piloting the 4-day work week for generations between May and September, even if nominally it was a 5-day work week.
Okay, this is the sad thing about Mediterranean cultures, or at least about Greece in particular. When I was younger, my grandparents would always have a siesta, you know, after lunch. That has disappeared. So the Mediterranean culture is getting infected by the 5-day work week hustle cultural situation, in my view. So we got to get that back on track.
Yeah, I love that. No, bring nap culture back into it.
What's something you guys think is underrated?
So I have a serious one and a not so serious one. My honest answer, the first thing that came to mind with what's underrated was Bridgerton season 2, a discussion topic that I'm not sure is going to hit with this particular.
No. I know we know it's been taking people by storm. I saw the first season and I was like, it's better than season 1. They're like, it's way better than season 1. Although it was, I think I just found myself waiting to see what the Duke would do in the bedroom all of season one. But now we've got a little more texture to this season.
Now it's the Viscount. We're waiting to see what the Viscount's going to do.
Oh, okay. Right, right, right.
Big difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Everyone I talked to said they didn't like it. And I'm like, listen, this is trash TV at its finest. Let's appreciate it for what it is.
Right.
What's your serious one?
My serious one was Community. I think Community is underrated, especially in the United States. Mm. I think, you know, the decline in religion in the United States, the decline of various civic institutions has meant that people haven't formed new communities yet in the way that they should to replace some things that have been lost. And I think that that's causing a lot of loneliness. It's causing a lot of ennui on a societal level. So yeah, Community. Let's bring
what
that
do you
back.
See as the most like promising like way to progress towards a solution to that? Because yeah, we talk about that a lot on the show.
I think honestly, it's people making hyper local communities and things that they totally dig. My friends and I in New York were putting on a pole dancing show every month that became like a pretty big event in the pole dancing world in New York. And it's like this tiny little niche underground community, but it did a lot for people. So I think if people just follow in the direction of things that they like to do and create community around that, that will work. We don't need a bigger idea than that.
Mm. Zachary, what is something you think is underrated?
Zachary is fine. Anything with a Z will do.
Okay.
I think the vitality of cities is being underrated, kind of apropos some of Emma's point. And the glee of reporting on the demise of cities, both during COVID and now, I think the excessive sort of strange rubbernecking, obsessive look at crime in cities. Also, it's very selective. I mean, crime's rising in Miami just as it is in New York, but you don't hear about it because people feel differently about Miami than they do about New York. Crime's rising in London. I mean, crime's rising in every big city post-COVID as things sort of, you know, fitfully return or resume or pick up a thread. And I think hope's underrated as a thing that is vital to the human experience about being able to shape our future. And the very fact that you can't say that without a certain internal cringiness, like, oh, you know, that's going to land like a thud in a cynical forest is part of the problem. But that doesn't mean that it's not absolutely essential and vital to all of us, to our futures, to the relationships we want to build, to the world we want to live in.
Yeah, for sure. Like, we've talked a lot about the over-reporting of crime. Like, I've had to like mute various like promoted tweets in the past couple weeks that are just like watching police tackle criminals, essentially. Like, I don't know where they got the idea that like that's what I wanted to see, but it seems like there's like a resurgence of that agenda item being pushed. And maybe like that's based on people being receptive to it. But what would you say are like the like positive sort of ignored aspects of like what's going on in cities when you talk about the vitality?
I mean, we're all somewhat a product of the lens and where we are, but in the past few weeks, I've been in Los Angeles, I've been in Paris, I've been in New York, I've also been in Miami, you know, in the past couple of months. And there is a real sense, a palpable sense of people kind of being out and living their lives. Now, yes, there remains an unspecified and ever-morphing threat of COVID and what that means. But it's also clear that people have, as human beings have from time immemorial, recognized that the needs of the living have to be met, right? And some of that, unfortunately, carries with it X risk of harm, as it always has, disease being one of the more primary ones. But so is crime and so are accidents. And how you navigate that is both individually and collectively incredibly variable over time. But it, you know, it does matter of like, what do you see in the picture when you walk out? What does your eye focus on? And I'm not saying you should ignore real human suffering. I'm saying that laser-like focusing only on that and not on the life around it is as imbalanced as only focusing on, hey, things are great. It's like only focusing on Miami being a tech bro crypto haven and not looking at the fact that its infrastructure is strained and, you know, it too has rising crime. Like, that's just part of the mix.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing, especially with the crime stuff as it relates, there's, you know, a lot of people have pointed to that the not all violent crime has increased and a lot of the crimes have gone down, but a lot of there has been an increase in gun violence and things like that, that have sort of these more sensational aspects of it that help feed this narrative. While we've also seen that there's a huge push from, like, you know, lobbyists, whether that's like, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and things, who are very much focused on like turning this into like a local thing about district attorneys and like how new sentencing guidelines are brought out. But yeah, it's I think there's so many ways to look at an issue, whether it's, yeah, there are very some specific crimes are going up. As a whole, though, we're not looking at something like that's arriving quite at the level of like certain articles we see, especially like in the like LA Magazine or the New York Times, where like the sources are just the police. And then there's like no other source of like any information. And it's merely like, yeah, and that's sort of what's going on. Take it away. But we lose some of that because we're not able to, like, because we're so focused on that, we're not able to actually acknowledge the one thing, which is a lot of crime has gone down. But it's for, you know, for whatever reason, the focus is on everything. It's like a runaway crime spree at the moment.
And it's also lazy use of statistics. I mean, in New York, there was a ABC News. I mean, this was actually put out by multiple news sources saying transit crime is up 50 or 60% year over year. I don't know if it was 50 or 60 or 65, but it was something a lot. It was a big percentage number, without recognizing that ridership is up 100% year over year, because a year ago, people were still, I mean, they're not fully back at work, Emma. There's a kind of an informal 3-day work week. But, you know, if your ridership doubles and your absolute number of crime goes up, your way of looking at that should actually look at it as a per capita reality, not just as an absolute one. I mean, 10 crimes out of a million riders and, you know, 22 crimes out of 3 million riders is still 120% increase in crime, but it sure is, it's a completely different reality if you looked at it in context, but nobody does that.
Right.
I mean, the media does that a lot, where they track things year by year, where it's like, it's almost meaningless. You know, you have to look, I feel like, 5 years in either direction to really understand if a trend is going up or down. And yeah.
Yeah. And crime just broadly is down, right? Like, where as compared to the 90s and yeah.
Or the early 2000s, right? And I mean, I try to talk to people about this thing. Oh my God, New York used to be so safe. Or LA, you know, downtown LA. Like, downtown LA, you know, was safe for like a nanosecond between 2018 and 2019. You know, for the 30 years before that, it was the place you dared not go. I mean, I'm being hyperbolic. I get it. But the fact is, you know, yes, human beings, we all live at our highest set point, right? We always remember the most amount of money we have, the most we were earning, and the least we were paying. And that's just kind of human nature. And we don't deal well with our set point going down. We're great when our set point goes up, right? Like, no problem. got more money tomorrow than I did today, or, you know, I feel better today, or I lost weight. We have a much harder time. Arthur Brooks talks a lot about this. We did a great podcast with him, and he's got this wonderful new book he has out. But, you know, we don't do well with one step back. We're fine with the two steps forward. And that has always been human nature. I don't think that's a social media phenomenon, but it certainly gets amplified and echoed in a way that doesn't do any of us much good.
Yeah. Well, I think, I think the hard part is that people who want to influence policy realize that and sort of employ that tactic pretty cynically, because we see it constantly, whether that relates to seeding this idea that like crime is completely out of control every single place you go, or that the pandemic is over. You know, right. Like, there's like so many versions of this.
And the crime thing is, you know, it's a somewhat of a pernicious boomerang from the Black Lives Matter summer of 2020. And it's, you know, it is a way for some people politically to use this as a cudgel of, the four people who actually did want to defund the police saying, well, it's all because of that we now have this.
Right. When there's also no evidence that they were actually defunded too, because that's another thing.
No, they weren't. There was a little bit of talk for a little bit of time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But just talking about it was enough to embolden the criminals and make them.
Right. And arm the police with a really nice talking point. And they're like, we're defunded.
I don't know, man. Sorry, we're defunded.
You're like, yeah. There's an actual robbery happening. But
all right, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey, here's something you might not know about wireless. Sometimes what you see isn't what you get. But with Visible, what you see is what you get. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 per month, taxes and fees included. Visible is the wireless company that makes wireless visible. No hidden fees, no really. Save on wireless with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You don't need more than one line of wireless to save. Just switch to Visible at Visible.com. Save on wireless without the hassle. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
And we're back. And so Democrats find themselves in the, like, the New York Times called it Democrats' Mystery, How to Brighten a Presidency and a National Mood. It basically seems like, you know, just the
mood's down, folks.
Yeah, the mood's down. And the article also seems to, you know, take them at sort of face value when it comes to, like, what the mystery is here. Like, they're like, I don't know, like, should we emphasize the small gains we've made or try to make larger gains? And it just feels, I don't know, it feels weird and disingenuous to treat people's feelings about this administration like it is a mystery illness that, like, they don't know the cause of, and they're just trying to figure out, you know, they're floating some weather balloons up to see how this works and how that works. But I don't know, we talk a lot about, like, sort of a disconnect between the reality as people live it and experience it, including on, like, social media, versus the reality that I feel like the mainstream media and the mainstream Democratic Party seem to exist inside of, or at least, like, sort of message from the planet of. But I don't know, I think it, like, comes back to sort of an unacknowledged, like, I think 2008, like, probably, and the financial collapse, like, kind of ties a lot into this, and just the fact that that there hasn't been like sort of a reckoning in the mainstream media or with the Democratic Party with what happened there. And, you know, you had like Bernie Sanders as an insurgent candidate who wanted to address that, and Trump addressed it in his way, and the Democratic Party was kind of still in the middle. And I don't know, it just feels very much like, well, there are concrete things people are asking for. You kind of said you were going to do something with that or around that and have not done those things. But like, so why is it being treated as like, are they depressed? Like, what are they so upset about? Why is everyone sad? How do we make them happy?
I was just curious that what would be the, you know, top three list of things that they said that they were going to do that they haven't done?
I think voting rights is a huge one.
Yeah.
I think, I'm honestly, like looking at things like the unemployment insurance, like the weird math that happened around things being like $2,000. And I'm like, well, if you add this from over here and you carry the two, that adds to 2,000. The child tax credit lapsing, student debt, like, you know, student loan debt. There's a lot. Talking about law enforcement reform, not necessarily about defunding the police, but looking at that with a real clear eye and looking at things like qualified immunity. Like, these are things that were talked about. I never in a million years would think Joe Biden would ever touch anything with qualified immunity, but a lot of gestures were made in that direction. And I think, especially for, you know, Black people, we look at something like voting rights as being completely at threat, being threatened. And we see countless laws, like in places like Georgia, Florida, Texas, where it's becoming increasingly difficult to vote, even for fucking, you know, the people that they want to vote for. So I think those are like big things that feel very existential for people. I think, like, one, if we're meant to believe that the equation here is to vote the representatives into Congress that represent, you know, the values that we have, that if we can't even do that, what is the point here? Like, we're not even looking at, like, that should even, I'm surprised that wasn't one of the biggest things Democrats even saw, just like in the cynical game of staying in power, which is like, hey, they're trying to take away their ability to vote for us. But that's been, you know, we've seemed to let the obstruction happen, like within the party, and just kind of keep it moving.
I mean, look, part of it is that Biden was unpopular by the fall of last year, within 6 months of being in office, when it wasn't even clear that those things weren't going to be passed. And there was some effort. There was a, you know, a voting rights bill that the House had passed that was at the Senate. And there was also the Build Back Better omnibus, you know, was going to retain the child tax credit, was going to provide universal pre-K and more time off for working women. But he was unpopular even before those things didn't pass amongst a wider swath of the public than one would have thought. And what's odd is the lesson that government, including Republicans, learned from 2008, 2009, was that if you don't bail out people who are actually working and you just bail out institutions, you're going to create a lot of ill will. So there was, you know, $4 trillion of money during COVID, both in 2020 and then in February 2021, a lot of which did go toward, it was the first time in 40 years that lower quintile people saw some income growth, largely because of transfer payments from government. And, you know, that did not engender like, oh, we're doing well. You know, I mean, there is a degree of, you mentioned malaise at the beginning, Jack, that there is that aspect of what's going on that isn't purely about, I think, something one can point to specifically. That doesn't make it an undiagnosed illness. It just means, first of all, it's almost impossible to do anything right now other than those two stimulus bills during COVID that has anything resembling bipartisan support. I mean, there are actually things that have bipartisan support. Like, weirdly enough, criminal justice reform was the one bill passed that had genuine bipartisan support during the Trump years in December of 2018, that actually for the first time moved away from like a lot of the draconian sentencing that had become commonplace in federal courts, right? It doesn't do anything for state systems, which are different. But it you know, it does speak to, and part of why Em and I are trying to do this, our own show of getting people to look at what people are trying to do to solve things, is, you know, the United States definitely is in a culturally massive question mark verging on kind of despair and cynicism in a way that would have been really familiar in the mid-70s.
Right.
You know, it's not like we haven't been here before, and would have been really familiar in the mid-1930s, you know, would have been really familiar in the mid-1870s. At best, these are like cyclical things where we snap out of our somewhat illusionary view of us of being the greatest of all nations that has solved everything, right? A comforting narrative that's never been true, but which we buy into really easily for long periods of time. And then it's like something happens and we wake up and we're like, wait a minute, right? No, we're not all those wonderful hyperbolic Hosanna things that we said that we were. We've got real problems and we've got real issues. And the challenge, of course, is to have that clear gimlet-eyed awareness of what's going on without sinking into despair and cynicism, you know, without that then trending into the other direction. And we're clearly, whether you're on the left or the right, easily heading in those directions. And I think that's partly reflective of the fact that, you know, no political leader has anything resembling a majority approval, let alone much of a plurality.
I just add really quickly, Miles, I agree with you like 100% about the child tax credit. I think that was a really, you know, that was terrible that lapsed. One interesting thing about voting rights is that it is a very serious issue. There are several states where they're rolling back, you know, they're making it harder to vote. But what's interesting is that the Brennan Center also put out a report about all of the new pathways of voting that were open during the pandemic with mail-in voting. And what with all the hubbub about mail-in voting during the last election, there's actually like 26 states that made it easier to vote. They took the new pandemic pathways that had put into place about voting, particularly around mail-in voting, and they kept them. So this is just a side to it that is not often discussed. And, you know, it's the same thing with what Zachary's saying. We're not trying to paint like, you know, let's look at everything through rose-colored glasses. It's just a balance question.
Right. That you're sure.
Yeah. I mean, I do think, too, that, you know, there are some things that Biden is at fault for, like the massive cash transfers that went into place during the pandemic, like Zachary mentioned, were massively beneficial for people. It also seemed to have kicked up inflation. I'm not sure how much we can blame Biden for, you know, gas and gas prices going up and up and up with the war right now. So I think some of the malaise does have to do with like the Democrats are not delivering. And I think that they're particularly not paying attention to voters' concerns about working and wages and worker power mm-hmm. compared to corporate power. But some of it too, I do think it is kind of like there's a bad vibe right now. And I'm not sure that the Democrats are all to blame for that.
I don't think that they are all to blame because this is centuries built up where now like the lived experience of an American person is such where the American dream is, you know, not very accessible to most people anymore. And that the feeling that people have is like, oh my God, all that like post-World War II glow is completely faded away. And we're looking at like crumbling infrastructure, stagnant wages, and like really massive societal issues where it looks like the leadership in the country can't really like really address the elephant in the room, which I think for voting people is inequality. And like broadly tackling that issue to say, we absolutely hear you that being able to live in a city has become, it's prohibitively expensive. Even if you're just trying to, if you're a single parent, like good luck, like trying to do that. We hear you. We understand that that is something that societally feels like we need a realignment to say, what is the minimum that an American deserves, you know, like many other countries have that defined where it's like, you will not go broke because you've, you know, because you got into medical debt or things like that. If you want an education, here, go at it. Here you go. There's a place for you to attain that. And I think by not really getting into that part, I think it's probably messy for both parties because at some point they have to acknowledge their connection to it. And I think that's what makes it a little bit difficult is that the both parties in this country have been so entangled in that inequality that it's like they're finding it very difficult to A, acknowledge that the policies that they were supporting and with the hopes of thinking like, yeah, this is the way to like have all of the abundance flow to many people isn't working and to really acknowledge that, to really say that is completely failed and we actually need to think about it. I think that's what some people are waiting for is like, can we just acknowledge that this has failed? Because it's failed so many people at this point. It's hard to say that this is us moving in a beneficial direction.
Yes, I have two pushbacks on that. One is, I think it's not about inequality as much as it's about what you just talked about. I mean, you could reduce inequality, the amount of inequality, and still have people not be able to afford living in cities and going bankrupt from medical debt. It's the abundance part. It's the non-proliferation of sufficient abundance to enough people in an otherwise highly affluent society. And inequality per se is not, reducing inequality doesn't solve those issues. Just like, you know, as we see with inflation, right? Expanding incomes doesn't do you much good if the cost of things is rising more quickly than your incomes are expanding. If costs went down, which was somewhat happening with the deflationary effects of technology, then you wouldn't necessarily need more income, right? Because net-net, it would be the same thing. Your dollar would be buying more if the costs were going down. If costs are going up, your dollar is buying less. So I think it's more about the non-sharing of that abundance. And one of the real obstacles for the United States is the set point of the mid-20th century, which we look at as some sort of normative moment where everything worked. So many stars aligned in that moment that were both of our own doing and also global, right? World War II ends. The United States is 50%, more than that, actually, of all global industrial capacity, the entire world, right? We were this engine because we hadn't been bombed. You know, we were the one bombing. We weren't the ones getting bombed. We had emerged victorious. There was some degree of collective unity that had to do with white America, right? I mean, the GI Bill was great, but it didn't extend to African Americans. It certainly didn't extend to women. And yet we hold that up as the validation of a system that worked. And I'm really of the mind that we hamper ourselves more by thinking that we had a formula that worked that we are now failing, rather than recognizing that we never really had the formula we think we had, and it never worked the way we idealize it having worked. You know, that we were always much more flawed than we like to tell ourselves. We're always more just like a group of humans who had an interesting formula for social organization that did allow for things a lot of other societies didn't and still don't. But I think the fact that we look to that moment in the 1940s and 50s and 60s as this is when it worked and now we've failed, I think that's a false story of who we were.
I mean, who looks to that though? Who are you talking about when we talk about looking to the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s? I don't think that's who we're talking about.
Well, when I even say that post-war glow, I think I don't idealize any moment in American history.
No, I'm not saying you guys are, but I think a lot of our public debate speaks of a kind of something worked and then we got off track.
Yeah, the Republican Party and Fox News certainly do, right?
Yeah, but the Democrats do as well. This a time when there was more democracy or more egalitarianness or more rights that are being, you know, I don't think it's just one side here.
Sure.
What I see is that the media, like when I say this post-war glow, is that that is like you're saying, that is looked at as like something, you know, that like we were doing okay or whatever. But again, you look at even as you lay out, not all those benefits were distributed equally. In fact, you know, most people, especially if you are not in like the white mainstream, there really hasn't been a great time for those people in this country. And to say that, like, whether it's thinking that something worked and then failed or just saying that like nothing is going right, I think what we're saying is like the same thing, is that we're not actually arriving at a moment where we're trying to actually reckon with what's going on. We have ways to kind of shroud the discussion in something else than just silo it off into like a separate thing and just make it about, okay, well, let's look at how we can help out student loan, like people with student loan debt, or maybe we can look at how Pell Grants are distributed and how that's working. But again, all of these issues are sort of part of this larger problem that we have, is that most American people on some level have these like feelings of like, I don't know if I'm going to have enough to make it or to be have a level of financial stability. I look at that with my friends who are in their mid-30s who work at grocery stores still and talk about the stress they have from doing like smaller jobs because it was harder for them to go to college. They weren't taking out student loans and things like that. And there's I see firsthand a lot about how ground down people get. And that's my concern, is that I think, you know, even in a past episode, you talk about this idea of nostalgia that we have, of this idea of the return of the king. And someone will come to right all the wrongs. And it's really not that simple. And I know people still think that's like possible, but we have to sort of put all of that shit out of our mind and say that there has to be this basic reshifting, or really looking at the things that we're saying, what is the minimum? And I think that's, I think that's an easier place, a conversation to start for in general to talk about this is, what's the minimum an American deserves by being a citizen? What is that? What is that? What, how does that enable you to live a prosperous life?
Yeah, that I totally agree with. You know, that there should be some baseline understanding of what does an affluent society provide as its contract to itself.
Because,
as to the basics of, you know, healthcare, education, shelter, food, you know, not a particularly high bar, or shouldn't be a particularly high bar,
right,
of security. That once we've established that, then everybody's lives can go in all the different directions that everybody's lives go.
And one concern I have with the malaise like storyline is, you know, the last time the Democrats got like blamed for a nation with malaise, like, you know, that ended with, or that led to 8 years of Reaganism and Republicans like just sort of staying hyper focused on like the wealthy and like, you know, America's great because of this small part of what is happening in America. And I feel like that tends to be, I don't know, I don't want to see that dynamic again. But if the Democrats continue to be just like the holding bag for like everything that's negative, and the Republicans can just, you know, invent new versions of themselves, like, are we going to just be like yo-yoing back and forth between, you know, just insufferable like Republican leaders who are saying wild shit about what they're going to do, and, you know, threatening horrible things, and, you know, being horrible leaders, back to like a, you know, sane Democratic alternative that then everyone's like, yeah, but like this problem is still there. Like, I feel like that's the dynamic we're currently at, is that whatever you diagnose the problem being, and I think that there's a huge unacknowledged like wound from 2008 that like the end from like, you know, corporate, you know, when we talk about like Biden not getting things done in office and like it stopping with like Manchin and Sinema, like that was, they are like heavily influenced by like dark money and corporate interests. And, you know, it just feels like we're like the Democratic Party and like that mainstream has like chosen to be the sort of holding bag for like all of this malaise, but like they don't have like some alternative, that they're not choosing to offer an alternative, I guess.
I definitely hear you about like the wound from 2008. I talk about this with my friends a lot because I'm a millennial, and a lot of us got really screwed going into college, during college, and coming out of college. And it did lead to a lot of us, you know, sort of getting behind as far as not being able to settle a life for ourselves with enough money to buy a house, particularly in a city that's prohibitively expensive. But I also just think like the Democrats are not working with the things that they should be working with. Like Miles brought up the child tax credit. That also is something that has bipartisan support. There are Republicans who support various versions of that. They should be going straightforward towards that. Why aren't they? The whole discussion around student loan debt I find really odd, because once you cancel out everyone's student loan debt, you're still left with the undiscussed problem, like you guys are pointing out, that it's prohibitively expensive to attend a lot of private colleges. So you might have solved that, you know, in a moment in time. Okay, great. Everyone who has, you know, a lot of debt is free from that. But a lot of the student loan debt that's being held in the United States is from for-profit colleges. And like I said, it's not going to solve the situation of people entering into college. They're just going to graduate with more debt. And again, you know, the Democrats are also not focusing on healthcare. So
to echo that, yeah, there were things that the Democrats could have done in 2020 that, because of the party's sort of maximalist position about a lot of these things, didn't happen. You know, even Joe Manchin had a voting rights bill that he had helped craft, that he would have supported, that was far less than the voting rights bill that was passed in Congress, but was far more than no voting rights bill and would have given the federal government much more teeth to take on some of these restrictions in some of these states. There was also a series of social spendings that could have passed through the Senate. Emma talked about the child tax credit, but there was a kind of a maximalist position. And I think in many ways, you know, a lot of what is dispiriting about the Democrats is the degree to which, by trying to govern as if there was this huge mandate without recognizing that, look, I mean, there's a whole series of Democrats in swing districts in non-urban areas of the country. You know, people like Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan and Tom Malinowski in New Jersey, who's an old friend, and Abigail Spansberger in Virginia and Cindy Axne in Iowa, who support all these things, you know, and feel like they have a constituency that would support them, but not at the most, you know, we're going to remake society a la what more urban, you know, younger educated voters want. And by not taking the half loaf, you know, the proverbial, like not taking the deal that was on the table and going for the wish list, I think that's, I mean, it is almost impossible to overstate what a mistake that is. And it changes the narrative in a way that it didn't have to be. You know, there's more support for a lot of these things because they affect a lot of humans' lives, irrespective of what party they affiliate themselves with. And, I think that's going to be part of the real challenge for the Democrats, other than the fact they've done a really effective job counter gerrymandering.
Well, and I think the issue, though, too, is, right, like they'll come out with these maximalist solutions on the campaign trail to court the voters. And then when it's time for the rubber to hit the road, the lobbyists step in and completely derail everything. And I think that's a huge part. I think that's why, for me, I'm not sure how the current setup is equipped to actually take on these issues because they're so systemic. I used to be a lobbyist for a for-profit education institution, and the work I did had nothing to do with education. It had everything to do with exerting pressure on, you know, politicians to convince voters that this politician was using X policy to benefit them when they weren't. And my whole existence was predicated on a wealthy donor wanting to make sure that his business was doing well. And I think that's a huge blind spot in the discussion, is that it's not just Joe Manchin sat down and looked at the Build Back Better infrastructure bill and said, you know, cutting it back $1 trillion every couple of months, which coincides with, I think, why Biden's numbers by the fall hit such a weird point, because we started off this spring thinking this bill is going to work. Then slowly you got to see that a lot of the, like, sort of more corporatist elements of the party, you could see where their interests were. People suddenly are now voting to block bills that were going to bring prescription costs lower. And lo and behold, it's coming from people whose biggest donors are from the pharmaceutical industry. And I think, yeah, like, well, and all of that is pretty disheartening. But I think when that's completely absent from the conversation, we're going to keep getting stuck in this, like, abstract version, like, what's really going on, without, again, reckoning with what how the system is actually operating and who actually can, you know, pull those levers at certain points when they want to.
Yeah. I'm with you about healthcare for sure, Miles. I mean, coming to Greece and living in that's probably one of the worst European countries as far as health insurance goes. The dramatic difference between here and the United States is, like, it's unbelievable. I feel like I should recommend everyone, if they can, like, go live in Europe if you can for some time, see what the healthcare is like, then come back. You'll have a crystal clear idea of how much better it could be in the United States.
Yeah. And unfortunately, too many people are just living the version where they're experiencing the worst kind ever without any idea of how good it can be. And we're just grinding people down to, like, nothing.
I feel like that's it. It's like I've gone through periods where I ignore my mental health and just, like, grind myself. And then, like, you know, there are negative consequences. But if you just, like, don't take that as a factor into consideration. But, like, the reality of, like, living in America in a place where, like, getting sick or hurt can, like, bankrupt you is so fucked up and, like, so dark. And the fact that, like, you know, you would have to, like, that you feel like you need to suggest to people, like, you guys have to see this shit. It's crazy. Like, over there, you can get hurt and not be bankrupt, is like, that feels, I don't know. I think there are a lot of things that we kind of lose track of because we're so used to them, as you guys have kind of talked about, but that need to be improved and are the thing that is like grinding people down, like you were saying, Miles.
I mean, I will say too, there's pros and cons everywhere. So I would be remiss to say that if you're on public health insurance here in Greece, part of your medical experience is not going to be bankruptcy, but it is going to be bribing the doctors in the hospitals that they'll actually take care of you. So,
yeah, I mean,
health insurance is hard. Let's just say that.
Yeah. Well, because again, like, I think it speaks to this perversion of like certain industries where we're not taking certain things and saying that's not a thing where you need to go and, you know, exploit and extract trillions of dollars out of. Like, right. that's at a minimum a thing to keep people healthy and alive. Like, don't begin to mix that up with growth and shareholder value and those kinds of ideas, because when we do that we completely reduce people to just shit on a spreadsheet, abstract numbers, and at a certain point one person being like, I need to crank this up by 0.5% means tens of thousands of people going into bankruptcy. And we're like, we're completely, I think, divorced from like the humanity of it all, which I think is just it. Unfortunately, when that happens, a lot of the people who are the most vulnerable, we forget about it because it's not necessarily maybe presents the greatest threat to the most people all the time, but it simmers and it ends up, you know, where eventually that rot touches all of us.
Although I have to say, one of the things that really startled me in pandemic time, or the heart of it in 2020, was a fair number of us, I looked to Western European national health systems with a degree of admiration, of some sense that this is a public good, right? It shouldn't be channeled through private industry. It shouldn't be a product of a profit motive per se. It should be about, look, every person in a society should be able to get the healthcare they need for the lives they want to live. But those national systems were no more able to cope with the demands of a pandemic for the most part, and showed many of the same fissures between sort of haves, have nots that the United States did, partly because their own budgets had been eviscerated over the prior years because people didn't want to really pay taxes to support that collective good. And they were susceptible to the same mantras of efficiency. And efficiency means, you know, you don't have spare beds. It means when a crisis hits, there's no slack. Because slack costs money. All I'm saying is, like, it is true that we have massive structural impediments to delivering some of the goods that you talk about. But it is eye-opening to see the degree to which it's very hard to find a human assemblage on the planet that does this particularly well, other than some, you know, smaller homogenous societies. You know, you could say, look, Denmark does this pretty well, but Denmark's like, you know, Manhattan plus Queens. I mean, and that's not said with any pejorative, right? It's just, I think it's easier when there's fewer people and they're all somewhat related.
I do have to say, I bribe all my doctors just to like get better reports, better like test results.
Wait, what'd you put for my height there, doc?
Could I get an extra inch on that height?
Up to 6'4".
Drop like 20 pounds from the weight, and that cholesterol needs to come way down, bro.
You can bribe people here to get a driver's license too, which is why it's really scary to drive here.
Wow.
All right. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk for like 5 minutes about vampires, and then we'll let you guys go.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey, here's something you might not know about wireless. Sometimes what you see isn't what you get. But with Visible, what you see is what you get. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 per month, taxes and fees included. Visible is the wireless company that makes wireless visible. No hidden fees, no really. Save on wireless with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You don't need more than one line of wireless to save. Just switch to Visible at Visible.com. Save on wireless without the hassle. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
And we're back. And yeah, let's talk vampires. Vampires are back. I mean, I guess we should start off with the most important question, right, Miles?
Most important question for our guests.
Emma and Zachary, are vampire fangs hollow like straws so they can drink the blood through the fangs, or are they sharp pokers to create a wound to drink from?
Okay. I feel like there's only one answer to this question. It is the right answer. And that they must be like straws.
Otherwise, yes.
Otherwise, the drinking doesn't make any sense. It doesn't work. You'd basically have to like rip open a massive wound. You couldn't have just like two pincers and then what, lap up the blood? It would be like a little trickle. It doesn't make sense.
It's like an artery, though. You know what I mean? They're going for the jugular, maybe. So you got good pressure, good blood pressure coming out of there. But okay, I like that. Now I agree.
I'm going with Emma 100% here.
Wow.
This is huge.
Okay. Hollow fang gang.
So Miles and I like came up in the vampire game thinking that was how things worked, but like then were made to feel stupid. And like up until you guys just said that, I had felt stupid, but maybe not. Maybe this is the truth. Maybe we were right all along, Miles. I guess the devil's advocate is that like Capri Sun, you know, you can just puncture a hole and then just suck that thing dry. Like you don't need your teeth to.
There's one other problem with that picture, which is, you know, if you ever see a vampire, and of course we've all seen real vampires do this.
Yeah,
not just the movie ones. If they were just two puncture wounds, you'd have to first puncture and then you'd have to move your mouth because you have to move your mouth up to the puncture for suction. And that would be a totally different, that would be a two-step process on the neck. And you don't, that's not how it works. It's one and then it's a latch, and the latch doesn't work if the puncture is like significantly toward your nose.
It's like, plus it's blocking the hole in which the blood would be flowing from if the fangs are still in there.
Yeah. So I'm just saying.
Damn.
Thank you, Zach. Okay.
I mean, I guess we also have a less important update from the world of vampires in that Megan Fox and Machine Gun Kelly have talked about liking to occasionally drink each other's blood. apparently MGK will cut his chest open with broken shards of glass so that Fox can drink the blood. And the vampire community was like, whoa,
knock that shit off.
Sorry. What did you say?
Yeah. Real quotes from vampire. One man, Belfazar Ashantasan, the co-founder of the New Orleans Vampire Association,
Nova,
wasn't fucking around. He's saying most vampires, again, it's saying you can't just drink somebody's blood. What are you, sick? You gotta know whose blood you're drinking. He says vampires do extensive research on their blood donors before using even the slightest drop. And it says it took him 6 months to get to know his blood donor and feel comfortable before he would ingest the blood. And to the shards of glass thing, another vampire, Father Sebastian, the founder of the Endless Night Vampire Ball, said, you got to be careful. You gotta use like medical procedures to have the blood withdrawn properly. Otherwise, you're looking at a terrible, terrible mistake or, you know, potential harmful issues. So I just like that the vampires came out to them and were saying, this ain't some fucking movie where you just start sucking on a bloody wound. Get real. You need to have someone like maybe a phlebotomist on standby to properly do this.
I love the fact that there is a sufficient sub community that has created and delineated a set of really strict and clear rules of engagement when it comes to how you drink, what you drink, and from whom you drink. That never really occurred to me to spend time and energy mapping out the parameters of. And that's the really cool thing about sub communities, right? We go about our lives thinking, at such a point as you decide that you want to actually drink someone's blood, it's a pretty simple, basic transaction, kind of like Angelina Jolie and Billy Bob Thornton. You know, you just you put a little bit of a vial and you show up at the Oscars and there you have it. But indeed, you know, there's some real serious expertise and complexity there. Maybe we can talk about cannibalism the next time we talk, because I'm sure there too, you know, thermometers, temperature, you know, minimum,
storage
which cuts
techniques.
Are better. Storage techniques, right?
How do
you make sure they don't reach for the wrong thing in the cooler? You know, whatever. Right. I'm sure it's all out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all about community. You know what I mean?
Yep. That's what I was saying earlier about building communities.
Thank you.
It's very important.
Yeah.
Come on, New Orleans. Hit up Nova. Let Balthazar know you're here for his safe, technocratic form of vampiring.
Is there like a vampire name generator? Because like, is Belfazar Ashantasan, is that this person's legal name? Or do you, when you fall into vampirism, you're like, hold on, now this is my like confirmation saint name, Belfazar.
Like, do you like go through like the Anne Rice corpus and try to find, you know, your your spirit vampire name?
Right.
It might be his legal name if he changed it, but it's certainly not his given name. There's no way.
Right.
Unless he comes from a line of New Orleans Vampire Association members.
True.
Well, guys, it's been a pleasure having you on TDZ. Where can people find you, follow you, all that good stuff?
So you can listen to our podcast called What Could Go Right. We're on, you know, any podcast platform you can think of. We're at Progress NTWRK on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, if you're a LinkedIn person.
Hey.
You can also sign up for a newsletter, which is also called What Could Go Right. And that's on the Progress Network website, which is theprogressnetwork.org.
Yeah. Yep.
And think about it as kind of a yin to this yang.
Yeah. There you go.
Right. Balance in the force.
And is there a tweet or some of the work of social media you've been enjoying?
So not quite a tweet, but a tweet to an article, which was... Kevin Kelly, he was one of the founding editors of Wired magazine. He turned 70 last week, and he put out this list called 103 Bits of Advice I Wish I Knew. It's really great. It's completely random. There's absolutely no order and just like gems throughout. So I recommend that. It's on his website called Technonium, I think.
All right. How about you, Zachary?
So just for funny Tweetlandia, there's a woman named Eden Dranger who has a hilarious set of ever new Twitter feeds. One of her recent ones is, whenever I feel ugly, I just remember that I'm a terrible person too.
There you go.
And the other is, we should have to answer like 5 security questions before making any late night online purchases.
Yeah.
Wise words.
Got to identify which square has the boat in it before you make any bad choices.
And I'll leave you with the final one of hers. If I was a marriage counselor, I'd just let the couple log on to any dating app for 2 minutes.
There you go. Miles, where can people find you? What's the tweet you've been enjoying?
Find me on Twitter and Instagram at Miles of Gray. If you like basketball, check out Miles and Jack Got Mad Boosties, our what? Basketball podcast. Since we're, you know, again, we talk about the world here. We celebrate the NBA over there. Mm-hmm. And if you like 90 Day Fiancé, check out 420 Day Fiancé with your boy and Sophia Alexandra. A tweet I like. First one is sure from boy. Natasha Lyonne, because I've been watching a little bit of Russian Doll, the new season. And so whenever I see her tweets, I can't help but hear it in her voice. At N. Lyonne tweeted, "How come no one talks about WAP anymore? You guys used to love WAP." Random Natasha Lyonne tweet. And then another one from at Asante's Inferno tweeted, "I love that when British people sing, they cut out all that bullshit."
Yeah.
That was like when I heard an interview like Led Zeppelin the first time ever as a kid. I was like, wait, what?
What the fuck
is this? What?
Ooh, hey, wow. But sometimes, you know, Green Day adds back in from our end.
Suddenly we're so British again.
Tweet I've been enjoying, Gianmarco Ceresi tweeted, "Oh, you don't like cargo shorts? Let me check my 46 pockets for a fuck to give."
That's good.
You can find us on Twitter at Daily Zeitgeist. We're at The Daily Zeitgeist on Instagram. We have a Facebook fan page and a website, dailyzeitgeist.com, where we post our episodes and our footnotes, where we link off to the information that we talked about in today's episode, as well as a song that we think you might enjoy. Miles, what song do we think people might enjoy?
We're going to do an instrumental version, a cover by this group, Soul Supreme, of the track by Mos Def called Umi Says. A lot of people know that song, Umi Says. Umi Says, shine your light on the world. But this is a great instrumental cover of it, even more soul. So this is Soul Supreme's version of Umi Says.
All right. Well, The Daily Zeitgeist is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. That's going to do it for us this morning. But we're back this afternoon to tell you what's trending. We'll talk to you all then. Bye.
Bye.
Here's something you might not know about wireless. Sometimes what you see isn't what you get. But with Visible, what you see is what you get. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 per month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.